From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 26th, 2017, the last Sunday in February. Welcome to our weekly look behind the politics and policies that make Chicago, the state, and Washington, D.C. what they are today. Time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll try to get your day and week off to a good start. Well, we all knew that the weather had to break after that unusual series of June-like temperatures. But, you know, we're almost there, almost through February, and the month's almost over. And we've escaped pretty unscathed so far.
Two words are always encouraging, Rick. Spring training.
No kidding. And I even brought out the Cubs hat yesterday. And it was kind of, I loved the juxtaposition of having snow flurries and watching the Cubs playing baseball in Arizona when it's 83 degrees on Channel 9 yesterday. It was, I was surprised that they actually, you know, played the starters for the most part too in the portion of the split squad game that was televised, which was the against the A's. But it was just so great to be watching baseball again.
Yeah, and something else just came to mind. Here we are going to close out February this week. March 1st being on Wednesday, that means baseball regular season just over a month away now.
Wow.
I'm trying to think positive here.
How about it, though? The split squad game against Oakland. You said it was a split squad game? Hayward, Bryant, Rizzo, Zobrist, Russell, Contreras, Jay, Caesar. That's a split squad game.
Yeah, I know.
It's ridiculous.
I expected, you know, for the now obviously it's still spring training, but I thought, okay, I'll just kind of watch the game, but I probably won't know half the people playing in it. And I'm going, holy cow!
In the other game, you had Schwarber, Baez, Candelario, Montero, Elmora. I mean, you just had it's ridiculous. They're so deep.
They could break them in two. Wow, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. I mean, and you know, it's that crazy time. I'm watching baseball. You got all kinds of basketball going on. College hoops. We're going to be getting into March Madness real soon. And then, then there's the hockey. And a great outdoor game last night with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. I mean, the electricity you could feel with that rivalry was absolutely tremendous watching that game last night. Part of the reason why I didn't get to bed on time was watching that game. But it was, I mean, just some great, great sports times going on right now. I mean, I know there's that other event going on tonight where they give out some kind of statuettes or something, but I'm sorry, the Blackhawks are playing the Blues tonight.
The name is Oscar.
Who?
Oscar.
Oh, yeah, it's right. It's the Oscars tonight. But
the guy in the trash can?
Oscar the Grouch? Yeah. I'll be the Grouch that won't be watching the Oscars. I'll be watching the Blackhawks play. They're on a roll too. I mean, it's so great to be in sports in Chicago this time of year. And frankly, we had the back-to-back hat tricks by Taves and Kane. Unfortunately, there's the Bulls, but even they were able to beat Cleveland. Of course, LeBron didn't play, so that might have played a part in it. But there's something going on with the Bulls. I don't know. And you're trading Taj Gibson, and everybody was looking to see if Jimmy Buckets was going to be the guy to go. I don't know what's going to happen with that Bulls team. I don't know what they're trying to do there. I don't know. Sam, if you've got any ideas, let me know.
They do enough just to stay relevant, don't they?
Yeah.
And they win. That's four in a row last night. They're 30-29, so they're in sixth place. They're going to make the playoffs, but, I mean, maybe they win a game or two.
Yeah.
I think they trade him before the draft, to be honest, Butler.
Really?
Dude. I'd be shocked if he was in a Bulls uniform next season.
That, I would too, I have to tell you. But I don't see any direction from them at all. That's the real thing. It's just like you said, they play enough to be relevant, but that's about it. And that's hard to get exciting. It's hard to get excited for, and hard to root for that. As I said, yes, the Oscars are tonight. I have to say, I did see La La Land, which is up for several of them. There's plenty I've wanted to see, but I have to tell you, this has not exactly been, in the political world, it's not been a lot of free time to be able to go watch any movies anytime. You're afraid to stay off your social media for fear you might miss the latest missive from the Oval Office. And indeed, the president and chief Twitterer in chief has already been up this morning, taking on the failing New York Times, and then also making remarks about the DNC chairmanship's race, which we'll talk about, labeling it totally rigged. So that's where the president's mind is at this morning as we go through the paces on this Sunday morning. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's got us up to date on all of the sports. Producer Jasmine's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob's still trying to find the winter coat that he put away too soon. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead today, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to Democratic State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston. The senator is looking to the state legislature to make some changes in presidential campaigns. We'll talk to him about that, the return of the Senate to Springfield this week amid further negotiations on a grand bargain. Also, after the 8 o'clock news update, we'll speak to Brad Cole. Brad's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. That's the Association of Municipalities in the state. And we'll talk about their recently unveiled agenda as cities and their budgets have been struggling in the state's budget impasse. Then we've got the news update at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Chris Mooney. Christopher Mooney is another good friend of the show. He's director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We'll talk about the budget impasse, the 2018 election, and much more. That's all coming up, but time for a break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. A little bit chilly this morning. Supposed to warm up into the 40s by noon, but some very brisk winds today. So keep that in mind. Although the good news is the winds are going to be coming out of the south, so that's going to bring some warmer weather in. So time for our weekly spin through national politics. And, of course, yesterday was the big vote by the Democratic National Committee to elect its new chairman. And, of course, Democrats kind of struggling to find their identity after the November election results and kind of seeing these two wings, the more establishment wing of the party versus the Bernie Sanders more progressive wing of the party. And in the end, after two ballots, former Labor Secretary Tom Perez was elected chairman of the DNC, defeating Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota. Perez, the former Labor Secretary under President Obama, won with 235 votes out of 435 votes cast. The other 200 went to Ellison. He was being backed by Senator Bernie Sanders. After winning the post, Perez named Ellison as deputy party chairman, And the one thing that at least what might appear to be these two disparate wings, one thing they have in common, and one thing that may turn out to be a very unifying factor, is their opposition to President Trump. As I said, the president on Twitter this morning labeling the results of the DNC election as rigged, and rigged against Bernie Sanders. You may remember that's kind of cutting and pasting from some of Trump's remarks during the presidential campaign and his thoughts on Bernie Sanders. Also, we've had the president announce that he won't be attending the White House Correspondents' Dinner. It's kind of interesting because a lot of people think part of the real motivation for Trump to get in the race for president was the way that then-President Obama and others mocked Trump during his attendance at a White House Correspondents' Dinner. And, of course, we have the president still taking on the media, still referring to the media as the enemy of the people, which we're not. And I thought, actually, Scott Pelty opening up the CBS Evening News the other night, very interesting, opening up a national broadcast by saying that while President Trump may think he's at war with the media, it's apparent from his remarks that really he's at war with the facts. We also had on Friday Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, selectively picking media to meet with for his press briefing, a major departure from the past and a continued symbol of the authority that the Trump White House is using. Now, interestingly enough, Spicer said after the election that you couldn't ban media from White House events. He said that that's what separates a democracy from a dictatorship. Well, that all followed Trump's appearance at the conservative CPAC conference, where he again went on to criticize the media, this time over reports that the White House tried to get the FBI to discredit stories about contacts that the Trump campaign had with known Russian contacts. The FBI refused that request from the White House. The White House, of course, says that's fake news. And Trump, who himself played the role of an anonymous source to help build his business in New York, decried the use of anonymous sources. So even his White House held a briefing that morning attributable only to unnamed senior-level officials. So at CPAC, the president continued to talk about defeating Hillary Clinton, a campaign that ended more than 100 days ago. And he focused on her use of the word deplorables.
Hillary called them deplorable. They're not deplorable. That a word was going to play so badly.
Also at CPAC, Trump defended his efforts to curb immigration as part of his war on terrorism.
Take a look at what's happening to our world, folks. And we have to be smart. We have to be smart. We can't let it happen to us. So let me state this as clearly as I can. We are going to keep radical Islamic terrorists the hell out of our country.
Now, it's kind of interesting because we've learned that Trump's new national security advisor actually has discussed that use of the term radical Islamic terrorists and says it's not helpful to U.S. relations and the cause of the U.S., and that basically these terrorists and ISIS are non-Islam. And so another kind of contradictory issue going on inside the new Trump administration. With a new emphasis on deportations and a wider net being used by the White House to go after undocumented immigrants, White House spokesman Sean Spicer denied that that effort was mass deportation.
What we have to get back to is understanding a couple things. There's a law in place that says, you know, if you're in this country illegally, that we have an obligation to make sure that the people who are in our country are here legally. What the order sets out today is ensures that the million or so people that have been adjudicated already, that there's a that ICE prioritizes, creates a system of prioritization, and make sure that, we walk through that system in a way that protects this country. This is consistent with everything the president has talked about, which is prioritizing the people who are here who represent a threat to public safety or have a criminal record.
So that, of course, is White House spokesman Sean Spicer. Going back to that CPAC conference, top Trump aide Steve Bannon appeared on stage with White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. Both insisted they were partners, despite stories of who has more influence with the president. But one thing, it was kind of, you had Priebus kind of offering a positive outlook, and then you had Bannon, who offered a very dark, deconstructive view of government. And he warned that the cries from political opponents, including the media, will only get worse.
It's not only not going to get better, it's going to get worse every day in the media. And here's why. But by the way, the internal logic makes sense. They're corporatist, globalist media that are adamantly opposed to an economic nationalist agenda like Donald Trump has. President Trump really laid this out, as Ryan said, many years ago at CPAC. It's really CPAC that really originally gave him the springboard. It's the first time at Breitbart we started seeing him and saw how people read, you know, his speeches resonated with people. And then he would go out to these smaller town halls later, and really he got traction with the same message he's bringing today. Here's where it's going to get worse, because he's going to continue to press his agenda. And as economic conditions get better, as more jobs get better, they're going to continue to fight. If you think they're going to give you your country back without a fight, you are sadly mistaken.
And that's top White House advisor Steve Bannon talking about the global corporate media and their opposition to Donald Trump. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to State Senator Daniel Biss, Democrat from Evanston. We'll be talking about the return of the Senate to Springfield this week and all the excitement that we can expect amid these discussions of the grand bargain. After 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to Brad Cole, Executive Director of the Illinois Municipal League. We'll be talking about their legislative agenda and their concerns as a result of the continued state budget impasse. And then we'll be speaking after 8:30 to Chris Mooney, the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And Ohio Governor John Kasich, who ran against Donald Trump for the Republican nomination and didn't support him as the nominee, he made a visit to the White House last week. And he insisted it was an attempt to bury the hatchet. And indeed, earlier in the week, he warned Trump that words matter.
When you're the governor of a state and you're an executive, you assemble your team and then you need to get your sea legs. And I made mistakes early on as governor. In fact, my wife once told me, John, you're the father of Ohio, act like it. And the fact of the matter is that words matter. I think the administration needs to understand that loose words, frankly, causes great concern. And one of the things that's amazed me on this trip over here is, as much as the Europeans criticize the United States of America, they love us, they need us, and they tell us that. And in some sense, they're almost begging us to say, please stand with us. You're the leader. No one else can fill your role. So I think it's just very important that in any administration, it gets its sea legs, that it's stable, and realizing that things that get said out of that White House really matter, not just in America, but all over the world.
Ohio Governor John Kasich. Yes, it's words do matter. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston. Senator, thanks for getting up with me this morning. And I know this is kind of your pit stop on the way before you do the hustle up the Hancock this morning.
Yes, thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me. And my own little demonstration that words matter is that when I was asked months ago whether I would run up the Hancock Tower to help raise money for the Respiratory Health Association, back then it sounded like a great idea, and I said yes, and now I've got a lot of climbing to do later on this morning.
Well, so but you could be like others. You could say, well, that was fake news when you said it, right?
I could. I think that only works for one or two elected officials in this country.
Understood. Well, I wanted to thank you for joining me this morning. And actually, first, given the fact of the election of the new Democratic National Chairman, Tom Perez, the former Labor Secretary, and, you know, a lot of people saw this election as kind of a proxy battle of the old Hillary Clinton establishment, the Obama establishment, versus the Bernie Sanders and the progressive with Keith Ellison. Just wanted to get your thoughts on the direction of the party.
Yeah, thanks for asking. And I'll tell you, I was supporting Keith Ellison for DNC chair because of what you said, that I felt that there was a troubling rift in the party, that a lot of Sanders supporters didn't feel as included in the party as they should and as the party needs to make them felt. And I thought that having Keith Ellison, a vocal Sanders supporter, leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, as the DNC chair would help bring folks in. The good news is that Tom Perez is also a progressive. He was an excellent labor secretary, not just a good one, an excellent labor secretary who did a series of important things for workers, for the progressive movement in the Obama administration. And he also immediately, after being narrowly elected DNC chair, moved to make Keith Ellison the deputy chair. And so I think he shares many, many, many values with Ellison, Sanders, and their supporters, and also understands the urgent need for party unity in this difficult moment where Donald Trump is president of the United States and the Democratic Party is really, in a lot of respects, the only thing standing between Donald Trump and making dangerous moves that would harm this country for not just years, but decades and generations.
Well, and some have suggested that if there is a unifying, one unifying theme for Democrats that might be somewhat disparate is Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I feel like I've become almost a professional protester recently. You know, the Women's March, of course, was an incredible experience here in downtown Chicago on the 21st of January, the day after the inauguration. But there have been a series of demonstrations and protests and actions and organizing efforts on a almost daily basis since then. And as I go from event to event, from rally to rally, and work with group after group after group, what I find is there's an awful lot of people in those crowds who were passionate supporters of Bernie Sanders in the primary. There's an awful lot of people in those crowds who were supporters of Hillary Clinton in the primary. And they're unified not only in their terror at the disastrous and immoral and un-American things Donald Trump is doing, but also in their vision for a better country with economic and social justice. And so I think this is an opportunity for Democrats to unify around core principles, to unify in opposition to something dangerous, and to step forward as a single united front.
But is this something that is sustainable?
What I tell groups that I meet with is we can't know what Donald Trump is going to say tomorrow or next month or 6 months from now. What we can know, what we do know, is that we have to stay active and united because there is a great likelihood that something dangerous will be coming out of the White House in 6 months. And so I told people the day after the Women's March, today we're active, tomorrow we're active, next week we're more active. And I say that every day when I speak with more groups. And what I've seen so far is that the energy is growing, the passion is expanding, and people understand that we need to be in this for the long haul. This is not a couple demonstrations in January of 2017 to blow off steam. This is the building of a movement that'll have to sustain itself through 2017 and beyond to transform our country. I think we can do it, but it's going to take a lot of effort and organizing to make that happen.
I forget who the pundit was who said that, you know, here we are, you know, just over a month, and it's that the public is aging faster than the president is for a change.
Well, I'm certainly not aging slowly, but I'm also not going to get tired, I'll tell you that much.
You do have legislation that that takes a poke at Donald Trump, legislation that requires any presidential candidate who wants to be on the Illinois ballot that has to release 5 years of their tax returns.
You bet. Listen, I think the country right now is going through something a little bit scary, where we have a president who was not willing to release his tax returns and who, therefore, we don't know much about his finances. Well, that means two things, Rick. First of all, it means that he ran on this platform of saying, hey, look, I'm the great businessman. You should support me because I'll be a good businessman for America the way I was for myself. Well, we haven't seen his tax returns. We don't really know how good a businessman he was. But more importantly than that, there are potential conflicts of interest across this administration, including in its foreign dealings with other countries. And because we don't have access to information about the president's finances, we can't really know for sure about those things. That is dangerous for the country and potentially unconstitutional because of the emoluments clause of the United States Constitution. So for decades, we've had a broad tradition that presidential candidates of both parties release their tax returns, even candidates like Mitt Romney, for whom that was kind of embarrassing. Well, Donald Trump refused to do that, and what that told me is that it shouldn't just be a tradition, it should be the law. So I have Senate Bill 982, which says that you can't appear on the ballot for president in Illinois unless you've released 5 years of tax returns. I think it's likely to get a committee hearing this coming week in Springfield, and I hope we can pass it into law because I sure wish it had been the law when the 2016 election happened.
But is it really constitutional? I mean, can a state set up a qualification for office that doesn't exist in the U.S. Constitution?
I think so, and here's why. The state cannot say, here's a qualification you must have. Here's a thing you have to be in order to run. So, for example, the U.S. Constitution says that if you want to run for Congress, you have to live in the state, but you don't necessarily have to live in the district. Some states have tried to pass laws saying, oh, no, wait, you do have to live in the district, and those laws have been struck down because those laws say you must be a certain type of person, that's to say a resident of the district, in order to run. What states can do is say, hey, listen, the U.S. Constitution says what type of person you must be. We're going to say what you must do to appear on the ballot. So we're going to say, for example, you have to file a certain number of signatures to appear on the ballot. Illinois does that. That's constitutional. Other states say you have to pay a filing fee. That's constitutional when those states do that. And so what we're saying is not you have to have a particular thing in your tax returns, just you must make the decision to release them. And so I think that's consistent with saying you got to have a certain number of signatures, saying you have to file a certain type of paperwork. I believe it would be upheld by the court, and I think it's a good idea.
And would create a lot more work for those of us when it comes to presidential filing time here in Illinois.
I'm here to help, Rick.
I appreciate it. State Senator Dan Biss from Evanston. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue, joined by State Senator Daniel Biss, Democrat from Evanston. Senator, the Senate, after a week break, comes back into session on Tuesday, I believe. And there's been a lot of discussion about the grand bargain, the so-called grand bargain, the effort by the leaders of both parties in the state Senate to try to find some way for compromise to get through the state's historic lack of a budget. And I'm curious if you think this process is actually going to get there at some point. Republican leader Christine Rodonio had said we need to vote by the end of the month, really, to show that the Senate means business in trying to get things done. What happens on Tuesday?
Yeah, that's right. She said we have to vote by the end of the month. That is this Tuesday, and that's the next session day, so there's a real short window there. Let's back up for a second, Rick. The state hasn't had a budget. Well, by the end of this month, it'll have been 20 months that the state doesn't have a full budget. That's insanity. There's no state that's ever been in that situation before. The consequences for social service providers, for the mentally ill, for individuals who are victims of domestic abuse, for universities, community colleges, students, are horrific. And simultaneously, by the way, we're running up on another $11 million of debt every day while not funding these services. So it's an absurd situation that is dangerous and damaging and unnecessary. And so Senate President Cullerton and Republican Senate Leader Redonio have been sitting down and trying to work out a compromise, like almost as if they were rational adults who wanted to solve a problem. It's comforting given the rest of what we've seen in Springfield. The bargain that they've come up with has been evolving, so we'll see what it looks like on Tuesday, but it involves very significant concessions on the part of Democrats, pretty major ideological concessions, and then a budget deal to go with that. And you know, so far, Leader Redonio has been eager to get this done, but members of her caucus have been very hesitant to do so, and she hasn't been able to get the votes. We'll see what happens on Tuesday. I learned a long time ago that nothing good happens when I make predictions, but what I can say is I hope we can find a fair resolution. But in addition to that, I would say this. If we're going to fix the state's budget problems in the long term in a way that's actually sustainable and fair and reasonable, we have to go at our tax system and reform it so that it can actually be fair. We have among the most unfair tax systems of any state in the country. We have a flat tax provision in the Constitution, which means that compared with most states, the middle class pay more, the poor pay more, and the very rich pay less. And if we want to find ourselves in a situation a generation from now where we've gotten out of all these awful budget situations in a way that's fair and just and doesn't go after middle class families in an aggressive way, we're going to have to fix that too.
But wouldn't this be that time? I mean, you know, not to use the old crisis creates opportunity, but, you know, as we look at how are we going to get ourselves out of this hole, which, of course, it's not going to happen overnight, and we didn't get there overnight, but isn't that the time for that discussion of a more comprehensive type of approach?
Oh, you bet. You bet. We have been floating along for generations now, unwilling to make the structural changes that are going to have to happen if we want a sound, sustainable, fair budget system. And now is the time. That to get there, we may have to make some temporary steps on the way because some of these changes require constitutional amendments. But now is the time. And as somebody who's got small children in the state, has the honor and privilege of serving in the legislature, I am judging my actions on the question of whether, when my kids are in college, we'll have fixed the real problems and won't be experiencing this type of crisis after crisis after crisis.
Did Governor Rauner, in his budget message, where he offered some parameters of things that he could accept and things that he wouldn't accept, was that helpful to the process? I mean, it's for his part, in some respects, I wonder if it's a damned if you don't, damned if you do kind of thing, only because you had some Senate Republicans saying, oh, I don't know if I'm going to go for this if he's not going to go for it. But at the same time, some of the things that he pointed out are still kind of anathema to the overall process of getting a resolution.
Oh, I don't think the governor's damned if you do, damned if you don't at all. I think he's damned if he doesn't do his job. But if he actually were to get in the game and begin leading this process and sit down at the table and try to work out a budget, I think he'd be in great shape. What he has done so far is to say, hey, number one, I want to make sure we keep on overtaxing the middle class and keep on letting the billionaires off scot-free. He said that's priority number one. Make sure our tax system stays the way it is so that people like Bruce Rauner don't pay enough and people like your typical middle-class family pay too much. And then beyond that, he's not said much about the budget. He's focused on these other issues. I would say, listen, Governor, job number one is to get a balanced budget. Come to the table, negotiate, lay your cards on the table. You're a Republican. I'm a Democrat. I don't expect to agree with you. But I think if you say what you're for and then we sit down and begin negotiating in good faith, we can eventually work something out. So far, he's not been willing to do that.
Do you think he wants a budget? Do you think he wants a budget?
I have no idea. He's not acting like he wants a budget.
Well, I mean, do you think there's speculation about, you know, this is just playing a game to see what happens in 2018? And there's speculation on both sides about not just him, but about Mike Madigan.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I don't know what's in his head. What I know is his behavior. And Governor Rauner is behaving like someone who doesn't care whether the state has a budget at all. He's talking about other things 24/7, and that's just not what he should be doing. His job His first job and his most important job is to fix the disastrous budget problem that Illinois has.
In the end, and we've already seen this a little bit about, and as you mentioned, Leader Redonio having trouble getting enough votes on the Republican side. And we know this is going to be a structured deal if it happens. But I have questions about whether those Republican votes will ever be there.
Listen, I don't know. They've not been there yet, and we'll just have to wait and see.
And plus, this is a package where everything's got to pass as well.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big, complicated deal with a lot for anyone in it not to like, and, you know, it's going to be a tricky thing to pass.
Well, as everybody says, the best compromise is where there's not a lot to like for either side in it.
Well, it's usually good if there's something to like.
Okay. I want to ask you, your name always pops up when it comes to issues of running for higher office, including now with as we're closing in on a year from the primary for governor. Have you made a decision about that? Are you considering it? Where are you on that process?
Well, I am considering it, and here's why. The state of Illinois is in an incredibly terrible situation now, and we need someone who's prepared to lead us out of it. We need someone to lead us out of it by laying out a progressive economic vision for Illinois, a vision that is about protecting the middle class, lifting up the middle class, and fixing the budget by going to the billionaires who have gotten off scot-free and finally, for the first time in generations, having them pay their fair share. We need someone to lay that vision out in a clear, direct and progressive, bold way, and then use that vision to build a movement that's going to be used not just to win a governor's race, but to transform governance in the state of Illinois. And I want to make sure we have a candidate to do that. If I'm that candidate, that would be something that would be exciting and a real honor. If someone else is, that's fine too. I'm going to be spending the next few weeks working out whether I think I'm the person to lead that movement, and one way or the other, I'll be making a decision and an announcement before too long, because if we want to do this properly, it's going to require building something over the course of many months. It's not going to be quick. It's not going to be turnkey. It's not going to be automatic. It's not going to be all television. It's going to be a slow, gradual movement of people across the state, and that's what's needed, again, not just to win, but to really transform Illinois.
Well, and you've sought to do that, to kind of be a leader of that movement, trying to point out ways that Illinois could be better. I don't mean this in an offensive way, but in a cerebral way, in a more comprehensive global way than just kind of quick messaging, you know, a series of web videos. Even the super PAC that you headed, it was about building Illinois.
Well, that's right. I have been saying for years that Bruce Rauner is a terrible, terrible failed governor with a huge negative impact on Illinois. Democrats need to point that out, but we also need to say what we're for. We need to explain how we're going to fix things. We need to lay out a vision for the state that's positive, that's bold, and that people can get excited about. And you're right. I've done that sometimes with wonky, long web videos, and I've tried to do that with shorter, more punchy messages. If I were to run for governor, it wouldn't be a campaign based on 7-minute wonky videos about tax policy, but it would be based on ideas and a vision and the concept that we've got to build a statewide grassroots movement around that vision, not just to win races, but to fix Illinois.
That's State Senator Dan Biss, Democrat from Evanston, and we'll be anxiously awaiting whatever decision is ahead for you.
I look forward to that. We'll be in touch.
First, you have to survive the hustle up the Hancock.
It's going to be a long day.
Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. That's the Association of Municipalities in the state. We'll be talking about their legislative agenda, prompted mainly by fears that the state may still not get its act together in coming up with a budget.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the All-State Showcase Studio. Was just out on the WGN Storm Center patio and Dave, you're right. Those winds are starting to pick up, and it's going to be windy all day long today.
Yes, it will. Keep in mind, though, they're from the south. That's going to bring us a little bit warmer air, which is why we're going to have a high of 48 tomorrow. So, you know, I'm trying
today,
to be positive here.
A high of 48 today.
Yeah, you know, people call me Dave the Downer. I want to be Dave the bright side guy.
Dave, the bright side guy.
Yeah, look on the bright side.
Wow.
I'm trying to turn
it starts here and it here, starts Rick. Right now, right?
Yes, that's right.
Remember, 8:08 on this Sunday morning, Dave, the bright side guy, is your newsman. No more Dave Downer.
No
more
Sunshine Schwanny. Let's go with that.
Where's Dapper Dave at?
Or
Dapper
Dave?
Oh, I like Dapper Dave. How about that?
Delectable Dave.
Oh, stop right there.
I'm leaving.
Okay. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks,
appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks,
Sam. Well, thanks, guys. Well, perhaps sensing that words matter, President Trump appeared last week at the Smithsonian African American History Museum, where he forcefully denounced bigotry and anti-Semitism, something that many in the public had asked him to do for quite some time.
Today and every day of my presidency, I pledge to do everything I can to continue that promise of freedom for African Americans and for every American. So important, nothing more important. This tour was a meaningful reminder of why we have to fight bigotry, intolerance, and hatred in all of its very ugly forms. The anti-Semitic threats targeting our Jewish community and community centers are horrible and are painful, and a very sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil.
That's President Trump from last week appearing at the African American History Museum. Now, joining me on the phone is Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. And Brad's got a great agenda for cities that was unveiled last week in Springfield, in part some of it due to the state's budget impasse. Brad, thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Rick. Always good to be on.
Moving cities forward is the agenda that was unveiled. And I know right off the bat, one of the things that you guys are looking for is an automatic appropriation authority for local funds from the state.
Yeah, and it's an important issue. And I know you just had Dr. Biss on talking about some of the budget proposals and the status of those conversations in the Illinois Senate. This is an issue that we feel is very important for cities and villages all over Illinois to make sure that they get those funds that are pass-through dollars, the motor fuel tax, and video gaming use tax, 911 revenues, things like that, that are collected locally but are passed through the state. This year, we're very grateful the General Assembly and the governor included all those pass-through dollars in the stopgap budget, but we'd like to see those on an automatic appropriation so we don't have to wait every year and see if they're going to pass a budget and so that those programs aren't held up at the local level.
One other thing I was curious about, local government distributive fund, that's the municipal share of the state income tax. And, you know, we always hear about with the state's budget woes, there's always some rumblings about whether there should be efforts made to reduce or take away from municipalities that share of the local income tax. What are you hearing? It's not part of the grand bargain as what we know, but it's still evolving, this grand bargain, whatever it is.
It is a discussion that comes up from time to time. And, of course, you have to go back to the genesis of the Illinois state income tax and realize that were it not for the local share of income tax, LGDF, there would not be the state share. There was a cooperative agreement put together that allowed municipalities to get a share so they would not levy their own local income taxes or payroll taxes. And so when you look at the legitimacy of the overall state income tax, the local share of that is as much a valid piece as the state share. And when you see that the cities and villages across Illinois can operate their governments off of 8 cents on that dollar, then the state ought to be able to operate their piece of the pie off of 92 cents. And I think the General Assembly and the administration understand that. It is an easy target sometimes for folks, but I would say the leaders in both the House and the Senate and the administration understand the importance of that LGDF share. And I don't think that's going to be an issue right now, but it is often talked about. But again, we go back to the good work that every municipality can do with that, and that's where they provide for the health, safety, and welfare of the residents.
Well, and the reason I ask, too, is because as part of the any kind of grand bargain or part of the parameters that Governor Rauner has spoken about would be a permanent property tax freeze.
Right, and we're opposed to a permanent property tax freeze. Of course, we think that the decisions that are best made are those that are made at the local level. When you have a local city council or a village board that takes action to generate revenue, and in some cases lower their property tax rates. Those are decisions that are made locally. Between the local share of income tax, LGDF, and property tax, which is decided locally, many communities, that's the only two places where they get any funds. And so for small communities and even larger communities and definitely mid-size, those two sources of revenue are very important. We don't think that the state should dictate a permanent property tax freeze since they're not involved in that decision-making, and local residents can elect their city council members and their mayor, and they're going to do that here on April 4th in just a few weeks, and they can make those decisions best right there at home.
So that would be another state mandate kind of thing, which I know part of your agenda is a constitutional amendment that would limit future state mandates.
Right. In fact, the property tax freeze, the permanent property tax freeze, is the ultimate state unfunded mandate. And we are appreciative of Republican Leader Durkin in the House, who's filed a House joint resolution to amend the Illinois Constitution to require the state to fund mandates. It's kind of common sense. We see more and more unfunded mandates every year, and they add up at the end of the day, and the only person that can pay those is the taxpayer. So when the state makes a new law or regulation, pass it down to the city or village, it's that local resident who's going to pay it, the same taxpayer. And so trying to look out for them to avoid any more of these unfunded mandates that just seem to come hand over fist.
We're speaking with Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Joining me on the phone is Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League. That's the association, statewide association of municipalities across the state. We're talking about their legislative agenda for the spring session. One of the things that I thought was interesting in this Moving Cities Forward agenda is the expanding home rule eligibility. And I know this sounds kind of wonky, but, home rule municipalities are the state's larger municipalities. And with that home rule power comes the ability to take debt. There's various other authorities that it has, taxing authority as well. And I guess I'm curious, why do we need to expand the eligibility for being a home rule municipality?
Well, you just mentioned a couple of reasons. And the state constitution allows municipalities over 25,000 population to automatically be home rule, which means that they can do things that the state hasn't that they can't do. Versus all the other cities in the state that have to go get specific approval from the state to do something. And we'd like to see that lowered to a 5,000 population threshold. Right now, there are 213 home rule communities in Illinois. About two-thirds of the state population lives in home rule. Lowering the population threshold from 25,000 to 5,000 would add in about another 170 or so communities. And that allows them to go out and they can renegotiate some of their debt service and bonds because they can get a better rate for it. They can enter into new intergovernmental relationships and agreements. They can have safer housing regulations, and they can put in revenue options. So it just gives them more choices at the local level. And as we see more and more issues kind of stalling at the state level, City Hall is open for business every day, and they need all the tools in their belt to be able to do the work for their citizens.
So more kind of local control, local authority.
Yeah, it allows the local elected officials to be able to make more decisions there in their community. And it's something that's proven to be a great asset for the communities that are home rule currently. And so this is something that will help, I think, stabilize a lot of smaller communities that maybe need some additional options.
Also on the agenda, tougher sentencing for repeat gun offenders. I don't normally think of that necessarily as a kind of a municipal agenda item.
Well, it's something that's been raised by a number of our members, and as we see more and more gun violence, you know, the fact is that these are municipal issues because it's the public safety officers in the communities that are trying to provide for the public safety in that city or village. And when we see repeat gun offenders back on the streets sooner, you know, that just adds more likelihood of additional violence. And one of the things that we're starting to talk about now, this is a new issue for our Moving Cities Forward agenda at the Illinois Municipal League, is that with this proliferation of gun violence, you know, maybe there should be additional mandates on longer prison sentences or tougher sentencing for some of these bad seeds that are out there that are causing real problems in our communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's as you said, it's something I hadn't seen before come out of a municipal agenda before. But yes, there is a public safety cost component that exists here.
And yeah, and then there's all of the trickle down. There's all of the additional services and things that the cities have to provide, whether it's to the victims of gun violence or the offenders of gun violence. And so, you know, we're calling on the state to, and I know the state is looking at criminal justice reform, and we applaud the folks that are involved with that. We want them to realize that this has a direct impact on everyone's individual community. And so this is an issue that's important to us as we're trying to keep the cities safe around the state of Illinois.
Public safety pension consolidation, consolidating the over 660 separate public safety pension funds that exist into a single fund. Why can't you guys do that on your own?
Well, you know, because there are so many, and there's no mechanism to allow for the consolidation of it, just like the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, where every city and village in Illinois is a participant of this one program. It's managed at a statewide level, independent from the state, but there are individual municipal accounts within that fund. That's what we'd like to see with our public pension funds. When we're trying to get caught up on the funded ratios and making sure that the benefits can be paid, which they are, and there's no issue with that uniformly, but we'd like to see a consolidation of these funds for the management of them, for the investment of the dollars, so that we can see a return that's greater because of the economy of scale, slow down this ongoing expense with 663 different fund managers and investment managers and et cetera. It's really creating an efficiency that we think keeps more money into the funds so that the pensioners can have more security that their dollars and cents are going to be there when the time comes for them to start drawing.
And the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund is actually, when we talk about pension funds and the state pension funds, obviously IMRF is not part of the state pension system, and it's pretty well funded.
Well, it's, I think, 98-point-some-odd percent right now, which essentially is 100% funded. And whenever there's a discussion about pension reform, nobody says we need to reform the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund. They look at it as the model. And that's what we're saying. We've got all of these individual funds out there. Let's consolidate them. Let's bring in some efficiencies. Let's cut down the management costs. Let's reduce some of these expenses that are taking money away from the actual pension funds. And we think that that would be better for not just the municipality that's contributing the dollars, but for the pensioner, for the recipient, so that they feel a little bit more secure and they know that those dollars are being invested better.
couple of other things that are in the agenda that the Municipal League has presented to the legislators. Reasonable exemptions from prevailing wage. And I guess the question is what would be, and that's the requirement that municipalities and public works projects pay a prevailing union wage scale for people working on those projects. What is the Municipal League view as a reasonable exception from that?
Well, when we're not talking about doing away with prevailing wage, what we're suggesting is that there should be a threshold under which a municipality can go out and have work done that's not paying prevailing wage so that they might be able to get more work done. For instance, communities that are out doing landscaping work this spring, they're going to be out planting trees and trimming bushes and things like that. And some small to mid-sized communities may be paying two or three times as much for work to get done. That is really not, I think, a necessary for a prevailing wage rate. And we see a lot of times the workers are wanting to be able to do more, but because of restricted finances, the city can only go so far. So we see a threshold as a good idea that maybe under $200,000 projects don't need to pay prevailing wage. Keep in mind, the municipality can always pay prevailing wage if they want to. But perhaps a threshold can be there so that a municipality could exempt itself in order to actually get more work done, put more money out there with more people getting these jobs done, and have a better impact on their community. Still allows the municipality to pay prevailing wage if they want to. Doesn't require that they don't. Just gives them the option on some lower dollar projects.
That's Brad Cole. He's the executive director of the Illinois Municipal League, and that's the Moving Cities Forward agenda. And Brad, I'm sure we'll be seeing you in Springfield a lot during this legislative session.
Oh, absolutely, and appreciate your time this morning.
You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Christopher Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I can start feeling it a little warmer out there on the Storm Center patio. So still going to be a windy day, but a good day and the sun is starting to poke through. So get out and enjoy this Sunday. Friend of mine, Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post, tweeted this memo from the president, and it's said, in this first press conference after the appearance of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where I played the, quote, good sport, unquote, role, the reporters were considerably more bad-mannered and vicious than usual. This bears out my theory that treating them with considerably more contempt is, in the long run, a more productive policy. That's a memorandum from Richard Nixon, dated June 2nd, 1971, a memorandum sent to Bob Haldeman. So putting everything here in a little bit of context for you on this Sunday morning. Also helping to put things into context is my good friend, Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Rick. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Wanted to ask about what you think is going to happen. We had Senator Biss here this morning. The whole concept of this idea of a grand bargain. And I guess I'm just wondering if the weight of this grand bargain discussion, the talks between Senate President John Cullerton, Republican leader Christine Rodonio, I'm just wondering if the weight of this is just proving to be something that's too big, too heavy a lift.
Well, it may be true. I mean, the bigger and the more complicated a piece of legislation, the easier it is to kill it off, right? Because it can be death by a thousand cuts. There's always something for everybody to hate. And it's always easier to vote no, not always, but usually easier to vote no on a thing and explain that than to vote yes and take responsibility for it in the long run. So, yeah, it's gonna be tough. But, you know, whatever they come up with, it's going to be tough. Whenever this thing is resolved, it's going to be complicated. It's going to be hard. There's going to be hard votes. People aren't going to like it because, you know, our situation is so dire right now that there is no easy out, and every day that goes by, it makes it harder. So, you know, maybe this will be the one that works. Maybe it won't. You know, someday it'll happen. We'll just have to see how long it takes.
Do you think that the governor helped or hurt things when he used his speech to kind of weigh in on this?
Yeah, you know, I don't know about that. I know there's been a lot of commentary about that, and I don't know, you know, there's no obvious answer to it to me anyway. But, you know, the governor has to get involved at some point. There's no doubt about that, because he's the leader of the Republican Party, and, you know, he's got he basically has control over all the money for re-election, or for the big chunks of money, and you know, he's got, you know, he parked $50 million in a bank account a couple of months ago, just to, you know, just to say, well, you know, this is some money I've got over here they're going to use for campaigning. We'll see what happens. And that's, you know, in the context of Illinois politics, especially legislative politics, that's a lot of money. It used to be a lot of money in gubernatorial politics, still pretty much, but not as much as it once was.
Well,
So the thing is, he's got to get involved at some point, because the Republicans won't, you know, he's got to, because it's going to be tough votes. There's going to be increases in revenues. There's going to be cuts in programs. Nobody likes either of those things. And the Republicans have to know that the governor's got their back in order for them to get on those votes. And they also know that if they don't follow along with the governor, a couple of members didn't, they're going to get hammered. So they got to be careful.
I think it's kind of interesting. You're seeing some of these groups that have been traditionally allied with the governor, groups that the governor has given money to, that are really doing a pounding on some of these, on Christine Redonio and some of these Republican lawmakers. And I'm curious, you know, why, if the governor is for something, why he doesn't tell them to stop.
Yeah, I'm curious about that too. And, you know, on the one hand, you think, well, is this subtle? You know, we can start in these kind of crises, if people start getting into paranoia theories, and there's this in psychology, there's this phenomenon known as the fundamental attribution error, and where the idea is that we as humans tend to impute motive and intentionality to actions that aren't necessarily, I mean, they may be random and they may be for other reasons. So we build these stories. And so that's where these paranoid thoughts come in, that we all have them.
Well, I mean, because people look at that and then they say, well, does the governor really, you know, want a grand bargain?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, we start reading the tea leaves, and I don't know if it's true or not. You know, I don't know why the governor wouldn't want to solve this problem. See, I mean, it is, frankly, you know, the state of Illinois right now is facing three massive problems that are, you know, they have somewhat of a relationship to one another, but they really are kind of independent in a large way. And any one of these three problems would knock most states to their knees. And we've got three of them going on at exactly the same moment. So you've got, you know, the way underfunded pension state pension problem. You've got this, you know, crazy budget impasse. And, you know, that's wrapped up. I mean, it's the structural deficit in the budget is wrapped up in the budget impasse. So that's all one big giant problem. And then you've got an impending strike by the biggest union in the state. You know, all of those things are happening at one time, and in any other state, at any other time, in Illinois, at any other time, one of those would have been, you know, a massive crisis. Now we've got three.
Well, and not to assign just a motive or possible motive with the governor, but also, you know, let's look at Speaker Madigan. I mean, is the bottom line, does either one of these guys want to settle this before the 2018 election, when Rauner's up for re-election?
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on in the minds of these two, you know, principal actors in this incredible drama that we have playing out right now. It boggles imagination to imagine that a Speaker of the House and or a governor of the state would want to see this state driven to its knees financially over the course of a 4-year period where there's no budget, automatic spending upwards to $10 billion a year more than revenue coming in, and lots of particular services that aren't getting, you know, gutting of higher education, gutting of social services. I mean, I can't imagine anybody wants that to happen. So I don't know why it's happening as it is. I've really just lost all I've lost all concept of what the reality is, you know. And ever since last November, I can't make predictions about anything. My wife doesn't believe a word I say. I kept assuring her that Donald Trump wasn't going to win. So I've also been shaken to my
core. Well, we could talk about that later, but what about as far as though, you know, as a blame game, you know, and early on we saw kind of strategic moves about, you know, who's to blame for the lack of a budget and who's to blame mm-hmm. for Illinois' economic situation. And, you know, certainly the governor has made no secret about, you know, through the state Republican Party that he basically funds, you know, where mm-hmm. taking down Mike Madigan's image in the public. But when you move into a gubernatorial election season, it kind of heightens attention on the governor. So
well, and everything, I mean, the whole structure of our government and the way our media works and the way people pay attention to government focused attention on the chief executive, whether it be the president or the governor or the mayor. I mean, it's the easiest person to identify with a particular government. They do their, you know, they do their best. They campaign to talk about you know, them as individuals and being able to do something in government. We kind of understand what a chief executive is because, you know, we work at an office where there's a boss or in a factory where there's a boss, or we're in a family where mom or dad is the head and they tell people what to do. So we kind of get that, and it's a comfortable world, whereas the legislature is just, you know, nobody understands that. You know, it's confusing. It looks a little nefarious. It's not really as prominent in the media. There's not an individual spokesman. So the governor really is the one, in the end, that in most people's minds represents the government. And I know they're working very hard to blame Madigan, spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars to make him look bad. And, you know, and for all, you know, they may be right. And maybe Mike Madigan is the devil incarnate and he's the one that did all this stuff. But structurally, it's a lot harder to blame the Speaker of the House than it is to blame the governor, just because the way people think about government and the way they, you know, sort of come to it through their daily lives. And so, you know, this governor will have to run on the record, and after 4 years, it will be hard for him to say, I, you know, drove this state into the toilet because I was trying to fight Mike Madigan, and he's the one that really did it. It wasn't me. I did everything I could, and he, you know, he did it. I don't know that that's going to be a real easy sell in the campaign. Now, he's going to have the money to drive home the message he wants. And, you know, so, but they are working to set this thing up. I think really what's going to happen for the governor to be successful in the next election is that he's got to have some actual success in governing. And, you know, regardless of how much money they have to run in the campaign. So he's, you know, I think it's really incumbent on him to find some way to make this happen, to resolve this. And, you know, on the other hand, the speaker, if it has really gotten personal, the speaker knows that he can, you know, he understands this as well as what I'm just saying, and as well as the governor knows that, you know, he could just sandbag him for year and a half, and he looks terrible. And you know, and that's probably the best way for the Democrats to win. So it's really a horrible situation.
We're speaking with
the rest of us.
We're speaking with Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. And on the phone is Chris Mooney, director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the state budget impasse, the prospects for a grand bargain, as well as political implications. And, you know, Chris, you touched on the issue of AFSCME, Council 31, the state's largest public employees union. Over 81% of the 80% who voted authorized the union to go out on strike. The governor, they say they don't want to go out on strike. They want the governor to return to negotiations with them. The governor says those talks have been at an impasse and doesn't plan to go back and negotiate. We've got that going on. We also have the issue of judge down in Belleville, St. Clair County, saying state workers should continue to be paid. And I don't know if that's going to be on appeal or what from Lisa Madigan's office. But, you know, is it that kind of a shutdown kind of thing? You know, we've talked about this so many times about does it take a cataclysmic type event to get these people to work together to try to get a budget? Is a strike enough to move things?
Yeah, I don't know how a strike would play into this, because I mean basically we've settled into a chronic problem now, and what we need is, I mean, and usually what you need to break these tough impasses, especially to do these very tough things, is a crisis. Normally under normal conditions, not having a budget for this long would it be a crisis, but they've kind of gone into,
yeah, it's a normalization kind of thing.
Mode. Exactly. With a strike, I don't know how that will affect the budget crisis. It might strengthen the governor's hand on the one hand, because if he can message it correctly, and I think he has, he's got his his points that he's making about, he says that the state workers are paid too much and that they've got these sweet pension plans and they're working only 37 and a half hours a day a week. If he's the one that can drive that message and it can, then he'll have the general public on his side. And that maybe makes him look stronger. I don't know how this, it kind of depends on how the strike plays out, of course. AFSCME, the public employees unions have been growing in strength, and really the only place where the union movement is growing in strength in this country for the last generation, really. But they're not industrial in unions. You know, this is not the United Mine Workers of America. This is not the United Auto Workers of America. And I've seen mine workers striking. They are striking to the death. I mean, they beat scabs bloody, and they'll be out on strike for 2 years to get what they want, because they are tightly bound. They work in teams, are underground in a dangerous environment, and they don't have a lot of options. So their backs, when it comes time to fight the coal bosses, their backs are to the wall. That's not really the same situation for, most AFSCME workers. They work in offices. They work they work out in the field in various places too, but there's not that tight cohesion that there is in industrial unions. And I wonder how long such a strike would last, especially with, this has been reported, not a significant or any strike fund to support these people. I don't know, how much internal support among its members AFSCME has. Nobody wants to go on a strike. Nobody ever. No worker ever wants to go out on a strike. It's a terrible thing. If you've ever been involved in a strike in your family, you know that it's hugely traumatic and scary for everybody involved. But sometimes you have to do it, if that's what the union or the group thinks needs to get done in order to provide leverage and with management. But in this one, I don't know how long it's going to last. On the other hand, I don't know what else they can do but go on strike. Because if the governor basically said this is the way it is and we're going to just impose our contract, if they don't strike, because that's really the only other option, you know, they basically just roll over and say, well, we just don't exist anymore. We're so marginalized that we don't matter.
Well, and I wonder, too, about, you know, just typical public perception and stereotyping characterization of a state worker. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that if that doesn't play into part of maybe Rauner's side on this.
Right. That's what I mean. If he can get that message clear, the message that he wants, I'm not saying it's necessarily the correct message, but if he can get the message that he wants that makes his actions look reasonable, he's trying to stick up for the taxpayer. And again, that's another big difference between an AFSCME strike and a UMWA strike, is that, you know, UWA, they don't, you know, when a coal miners go on strike, they don't necessarily have to worry about public image. I mean, there's some of that goes on, and there is that. But, you know, they're really fighting the bosses, and it's a power play that way. In this case, it is going to be fought in the public arena for both sides, because it's taxpayers in the end that have to, you know, the bosses, and, you know, they have to be convinced on one side or the other that, you know, which side's right. And you're right. I mean, when you've got a single messenger and you can tick off some talking points, whether they're completely accurate or not, that people can relate to, the governor's office might have the advantage in this case.
That's Chris Mooney. He's the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Chris, thank you as always.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good day.
You too. We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, State Senator Daniel Biss, Evanston Democrat, Brad Cole, the Executive Director of the Illinois Municipal League, and Chris Mooney, Director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening on this award-winning Sunday. And now it's time to turn things over to the great Dean Richards, because this is his election day.
This is my day today. Woohoo!
Yeehaw!
I like to call today Hollywood's prom.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of what it is. Everyone gets all dressed up. They've been planning for a month.
Sure.
They've been dieting, loading their faces up. So, honestly, most of them, their faces are so loaded up with Botox right now, they couldn't eat breakfast if they wanted to.
Yeah, except I don't remember a goodie bag at prom.
Well, that's true.
You know?
That's very true. That's very true. Do they have goodie bags at political things?
No.
Political events?
No.
I guess that would be called graft.
Yes, indeed.
So, it's all about labels.
Not the press does not get goodie bags.
Oh, well, you are the enemy of the people. Why should you get
Thank
any?
Thank you. Yes.
I don't know why Appreciate I'm not including that. Myself in that. We are enemy of the people.
Speak for yourself. I've been making it clear
I know.
That I am not
and
an
I,
enemy
I
of the people.
I enjoy that you bring that. I enjoy that you emphasize that every single time. Academy Awards today. We've got some of my interviews that I've done recently with many of the nominees. We've got my predictions today. We've got everything Oscars. Plus, what I'm super excited about is an in-studio visit later on from Jose Ramos. He is the one Chicago actor performing in the production of Hamilton that's in Chicago. He will be here joining us in studio.
Should I stick around for tickets?
Yeah, he may as well. I'm sure he just passes them out every place he goes.